Welcome back to Radio Entrepreneurs. I'm Jonathan Friedman, and today we're at the law firm of Murphy & King, learning how their attorneys work with their clients' challenges and help them to unravel the complexity in their lives. And my next guest is Ted Folkman. Ted is a shareholder in the litigation practice. How are you today, Ted?
I'm good. How are you, Jonathan?
Great, thank you. Thanks so much for coming in today and talking about your practice area. And I know that you focus in particular on international matters.
Yep.
And I want to talk today a little bit about your practice and your client base and how those issues of international law might come into place with your client base.
So great. Fire away.
Well, tell us a little bit about your practice, and I think that you know, people can think about multinationals very often when they're thinking about international issues, but I'm sure you deal with a lot of privately held smaller businesses that are dealing with international issues as well.
Right. So I'm a business litigator in our litigation department, and my specialty, my special area, is the cross-border transnational stuff, and it comes up in ways that you wouldn't expect. It's not all multinational companies or anything like that. I would say that for any small business or any mid-sized business, you're going to have international issues. And if you don't know you have them, you've still got them. Whether you have customers that are abroad, or you have suppliers that are abroad, or you have relationships with people that are abroad, you want to travel, it comes up in all kinds of ways. And oftentimes, the first hurdle to get over is to recognize that it's there.
So what would typical engagement be? I mean, I know I think people's mindset is, as a litigator, there's a problem that needs to be solved.
Yeah.
We've been sued, or we want to sue somebody, and obviously if it's of an international nature, you would be the guy. But what are the types of things that perhaps people, as you said, aren't aware that these issues exist? What should they be looking for in their business? And what should they be doing proactively to try and avoid, I'm sure, going to court?
Yeah, well, let me start with the proactive piece, because that's really important. You know, one of the things that I help with for folks who do draft contracts, and I'm not a transactional lawyer, but a lot of the complexity that comes up in international cases can really be avoided or at least mitigated if you're dealing with it up front. And there's a couple of things that I would point to as maybe the best examples of that is, number one, when you're making a contract or a deal with someone, thinking about the law that you want to have govern your relationship. And number two, thinking about where you want to be if you end up having a dispute. Just to delve into that a little bit, you may think if you're selling widgets to Canada that either the Massachusetts law or wherever you're located is going to be the law that you're working with, or even that Canadian law is the law that you're going to be working with. But you may turn out to be sort of unhappy when you realize that there's this international treaty that applies because you haven't thought through in advance how you want to structure your relationship. By the same token, if you are doing business, let's say in China, where so many American companies want to sell, you may think that if something goes south, I'll sue them in the United States, which is which is great. You can do that, but if you haven't thought through whether you have any actual recourse once you win and you have to go to China to make something happen, you're in trouble. So thinking ahead of time about where cases should be heard if they happen, and knock on wood they don't happen, and thinking about what the law is that you want to have apply, those are both ways that you can sort of radically simplify your problems before they arise. And if you can't agree with the other side, at least you know what it is you can't agree about.
So those are the types of things that I'm hearing you say can be essentially negotiated up front.
Absolutely.
Written into an agreement in the
right
event that something does go south.
Exactly.
And don't be so simplistic as to think that because it's going to be in one of the venues where one of you do business.
That's right.
That there could be international aspects of the law that apply.
Absolutely. And you also need to think about the possibilities of alternative dispute resolution. That really comes out of international conflict. That's where the whole idea of arbitration got started. And, companies that do business in different legal cultures, a lot of times they find that it really does make sense for them to agree up front that in the event that they have a problem, they're not going to deal with it in your home turf or on my home turf. They're gonna deal with it in a neutral arbitration setting in some third country.
So given that your practice is really focused on international law and clients, how is how you approach a client different from, say, somebody who's either a corporate attorney or a litigator domestically approach something?
One of the things that I have to do is to recognize what I don't know. So, for example, if I'm involved in a case that involves, let's say, French law, and I think of France because I've just been consulting with a French lawyer, you know, one of the first things I have to do is to reach out to my network of folks who practice and are expert in the relevant foreign law, and to make sure that we have a team assembled that can really address the foreign law issues in a really competent way. There are some American lawyers who are dual qualified, you know, who are qualified, who are admitted to practice in the United States and in Canada, in the United States and in Russia, in the United States, wherever. And that's great. But no one is expert
across
the whole
all
world.
Jurisdictions, right.
And so one of the first things you have to do, and you know, litigators don't really like to do this, but you have to say, I need help. I need to have a team of experts who can address the issues about foreign law that are going to come up. So you need to have that network, and it's useful to look for someone who has a network of folks in various places that they've worked with and whom they trust. Because if you're a businessman in Boston or in Worcester or wherever, you know, this may not be true of you, but you know, probably you don't have a wide acquaintance with international lawyers around the world. So,
right.
part of the job of your counsel in Boston is to make sure that you're connected with the people who can help put the pieces of the puzzle together.
And I would imagine that network comes into play as well in helping your clients guide them in terms of relationships that they might need to build. You know, if you have a relationship with somebody in China and your client is looking to do business in China, reaching out to one of your colleagues there might be a first line of saying, hey, you know, give me some suppliers that work in the pharmaceutical industry.
Exactly. I think lawyers can be really good introducers, good referrals for business people, a sort of trusted person who can point you to someone else who's trusted and get you in the right direction.
So given where we are in Boston and I think it's become a much more international community and not only in terms of the business climate, but I think Boston had a long history of being seen as a very sort of secluded, New England-only centric type of marketplace. But today it's really an international hub, if you will. What types of things are you seeing that have international implications? I imagine high tech and software and those types of entities see a lot of international.
Yeah, so I'll tell you about sort of some of the things that I see. And they're not all in Boston, I should say, because we practice you know, in federal courts and even in state courts around the country. Mm-hmm. But I would say there's sort of two big buckets. One are ancillary, what I would call an ancillary case. In other words, there's a foreign dispute and there's a little piece of it that has to come to the United States for one reason or another. So that you have that bucket. And the other bucket is, you know, regular old business cases, but they have this international component.
Mm-hmm.
So an example of something in the first bucket, and I do a fair amount of this, you know, there's some patent case in Europe, let's say. And they need to get some source code from a competitor in order to prove their case in Germany or in the UK or wherever. And the source code is located in the United States. One of the things that we do is we do the appropriate stuff in court to enable them to get the evidence that they can then use in the main case in Europe. And I'll tell you that European lawyers and you know, foreigners generally, they say, oh, we hate your legal system. You have all this pretrial discovery. It's expensive. It takes an enormous amount of time. It's an invasion of privacy. But when they find out that they can use it, they love it. So that's a kind of like an ancillary case. Another example of that would be you've already had a lawsuit in a foreign country, you've gotten this judgment, and you need to have it enforced in the United States. That's another thing that we do. Mm-hmm. The other bucket are plain old business cases that have an international component. And there's a couple of kinds of cases that you know you could think about. Some are more typical than others. I'll start with sort of the atypical because I think it's kind of interesting. People don't realize, you know, here in Boston, we have maybe 24 foreign consulates or trade missions, that sort of thing. And whether you're an employee who's working at a foreign consulate who gets injured on the job, or whether you are the landlord of a foreign consulate, or whether you have sold something to a foreign consulate, you know, suddenly you're in the world of international law.
Interesting.
So that's, you know, something that...
I hadn't thought about it in that context.
Yeah.
Anything that goes on with the foreign consulate is like happening in that country, right?
Or to
some degree.
It becomes more complicated.
Yeah.
It becomes more complicated. That's just, I raise that because, you know, you're right that people think of Boston as kind of a parochial city. But, you know, we have stuff here that, you know, you might only see in New York or Washington or LA, that kind of foreign presence. A more typical case, I suppose, are just the plain old commercial cases that American businesses have against each other all the time. I sell something to you in Japan, you don't pay me for it, and you say, well, the reason I didn't pay you is the goods were damaged in shipment or whatever. So you have those kind of plain old commercial cases that get litigated just like any other case, but it's really important that the person you have doing it knows some of the extra complexities that it sort of are inherent in even simple cases abroad. So, you know, for example, does your lawyer know how to go about bringing someone into court in the United States if they're in Japan or if they're in Germany? It's a special procedure for that. Does your lawyer understand from the get-go, well, what do I need to do at the start of the case to make sure that when I win, because I think I'm going to win, that whatever I get is effective and I'm going to be able to enforce it in the foreign country if I have to.
Right. Doesn't do you a lot of good.
Doesn't do you a lot of good.
A lot of money, win a case, and not be able to.
That's right. That's right. And that is not an uncommon. That is not an uncommon situation to be in, because there are a lot of countries where an American judgment, as a general rule, just isn't going to be enforceable, and so you have to think about what at the front end. What are my alternatives? I could sue in Middlesex Superior Court, and I can get this piece of paper that says you owe me $1 million, but if you haven't thought through at the beginning, what do I need to do to actually get the relief I want? You're going to be wasting a lot of time and money. Sometimes the answer is there really is no good way to get what you want, and it's important to have a lawyer
who understands that can
tell you that. Right. Sometimes the answer is yes, there are things you can do, whether it's assets held by third parties in the United States, all kinds of interesting ways of getting at the funds of companies that are in hard to reach places.
So it sounds to me like there's a whole host of things that you've done to set up an international practice, essentially, not the least of which is having relationships throughout the globe, or at least with countries that typically produce commerce. What was the trajectory towards accomplishing that? I mean, is it been a long process of developing those things? Are you part of international litigation associations that bring that? How does that work? Because it's really a high specialization.
It is pretty specialized. It started for me probably prior to 2011. I had gotten sort of internally in the firm, folks had been coming to me and saying, you know, hey, we've got this case in China, we need to serve the documents there. We have a judgment we need to enforce, you know, against a Kuwaiti company, what have you. I kind of got the bug for it. I started writing about it. I made some connections abroad, which led to some referral work coming from Europe, those sort of ancillary cases I was talking about. I've been lucky enough to get hooked in with some of the folks who actually make the private international law world run. There's various organizations that are multinational and so forth that have conferences, meetings, and so forth that I've been lucky enough to able to attend. And so I've developed some expertise in, you know, these very narrow but important areas, getting evidence abroad for use here, getting evidence here for use abroad. Service of process, enforcement of judgments, things that are not the daily bread and butter of a typical business litigation practice, but that more and more in the globalized economy come up. I mean, if you just look at the volume of trade, just take Massachusetts and Quebec, for example, close neighbors, it's huge, and it's only going to grow. If you look at the biotech industry in Boston, I think we're gonna see more and more big cases here as opposed to in New York or in Chicago or wherever.
And the same is true, I'm guessing, as with the globalization, any good and service, or most goods, I would say, at this point are probably sold internationally in some capacity.
Yeah, the supply chains are so long and crazy that no matter what you're buying, there's probably some international, it's probably touched the world of international trade in some way.
Is that a group that you typically work with or would work with, or clients have a good or service that they've sold domestically and then they're looking to do the international foray, so making sure that they're complying with local laws in whatever countries they're going into and making sure that you know, in the case of documentation or whatever they need to have, so help them with their compliance checklist?
Yeah, so I'm a litigator, so we tend to come into the case on the end when something has gone wrong.
Good point.
but it is certainly true that if someone, that we do make referrals to folks, whether in the United States or abroad, who deal with the regulatory customs and compliance kind of aspects of trade. I'm not a customs trade lawyer myself, but yeah.
So I guess, just touching again on the concerns of international business in this marketplace, what keeps them up at night? What are the things that they're concerned about? What are the things that you see, on the horizon? And I guess, counsel your clients, what should you be looking for if you're doing business internationally? These are the things that can potentially trip you up.
Yeah.
These is what I see on a common basis and what to look out for.
Well, there are traps for the unwary. One thing that folks who do business internationally need to think a lot about is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. We don't, in the United States, thank God, we're not typically making payoffs to people in order to get government to work for us when we need a permit or when we, need some sort of permission from the government to do something. But, unfortunately, that does happen in various countries abroad. And the United States and other countries, the UK in particular, have pretty strong laws against participating in that kind of bribery.
I was going to say we call it bribery.
We call it bribery, and you have to know what that law is and not violate it, even when you think you're beyond the reach of American law, because you're never beyond the reach of American law. So that's a real sort of trap for the unwary. I think folks need to think as well about sort of the long arm of the law in terms of human rights and. Labor rights and that sort of thing. There's been a fair amount of litigation against U.S. companies who are basically accused of human rights or environmental crimes or that sort of problem abroad, and then those claims are brought in the United States courts.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some narrowing in recent years. The U.S. courts have sort of cut back on the sort of grandiose notion that, we have jurisdiction over everything no matter where it happens, and that we've sort of gotten...
Rein that in a little bit,
yeah. But you do have to just beware that there are these risks, whether it's the Alien Tort Statute, which has been sort of significantly cut back, or the even the RICO statute. There are all kinds of ways that folks can try to hail you into court here in the United States because of something that it's alleged you've done wrong elsewhere. You also have to think about things in the United States that can have an international law sort of flavor or implication that maybe they didn't have before. And there, a good example of this, although I haven't done these cases, but you see there's been a fair number of them in the last few years of foreigners being brought to work in the United States as sort of domestic servants, maids, housekeepers, whatever, and not being paid properly. And in the old days, you would simply, if there was going to be a lawsuit, the person would say, you violated Maryland law about,
right.
wages, and there would be a simple lawsuit. Today, you'll see, this is, indentured servitude, and it's a violation of, the international covenant on this and that. So disputes that formerly, you might have seen characterized just as, just a plain old vanilla contract case, can take on that kind of flavor.
Hmm. So the complexity associated with these cases is much more elevated, and the dynamic of it.
Absolutely,
and the risk.
Yeah, and the risk. So I'm involved in a case now. It's a tort case, a tort alleged to have occurred outside of the United States. And we've gotten it down now through sort of very strategic motions to the court to what we think is the core of the case, which is was my client negligent. But when the case started, it was you violated customary international law, and you violated the Alien Tort Statute, and you've committed these federal offenses that are aimed at conduct abroad.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that what in the past might have been a more just more simple and straightforward case have become more complicated and complex, and certainly there's an expertise and a skill set that goes into dealing with that in addition to doing everything else we do in a litigation, persuading, arguing, strategizing, and so forth.
Well, it sounds to me like in that case, a client would be good to seek you out in the event of these international matters, because they are so highly complex, and you guys are certainly the masters of taking the complex and boiling them down to make them work and simplify it.
That's what we try to do. We try to work backwards, or at least I try to work backwards. We start off saying, you know, what's the end game and how do we get there? You know, if the case ever has to go to a jury, what are we going to have to prove and how do we get there? And working backwards from there gives you a good guide to where to go. You know, what I would say to people is, yeah, there are some cases that are so enormous and are going to involve proceedings on three continents. You know, there are some cases that are so big that you're going to need to hire, you know, some massive international law firm. Mm-hmm. There's just no way around it. You know, there's some cases that are just that big. There are some cases that are, you know, so routine that you don't need a sophisticated boutique-y firm like ours. You know, it's simple, and you could probably do it more cost effectively somewhere else. But there's a large universe of cases where it's hard, it's complicated. You need someone who understands, but you also don't need or want you know, this behemoth. Right. You want a lawyer who
offices on 10 continents.
Yeah, that's right. you want you know, responsive. Thoughtful people who are going to help you solve your problem.
Excellent. Well, that's a great segue into, if somebody had those types of issues or had some questions around international law or business challenges, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Well, you can reach me by calling the firm. We're on the web. You can find us. We got a beautiful new website. You can also check out my blog. It deals primarily with private international law topics. It's called Letters Blogatory. Which is a little bit of a pun. It's probably only funny to people who are interested in international law, but it's a pretty good resource, not just for interested folks, but for other lawyers as well.
Great. Excellent stuff, Ted. I really appreciate you coming in and being on Radio Entrepreneurs today. It was fascinating and obviously dealing with a whole host of issues and complicated not only by the international aspect, but if you add up the number of countries and how things can be done differently all over the globe, it certainly presents something highly complex in that matter. Just remind our listeners that you can like us on our social platforms or follow us at Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Google+. The video portion of this interview will be on our YouTube channel. And stay tuned, because we'll be right back with another guest on Radio Entrepreneurs. A video highlighting segments of this podcast can be found on the Radio Entrepreneur website, www.radioentrepreneurs.com, and the Murphy & King website, www.murphyking.com.